Hi, I'm Cassie McCullough, and this is Best of the Festivals here on RN. And today, it's a particularly sweaty festival and an open-air pavilion in Bali at the Ubud Writers' Festival. On stage, RN's Kate Evans with American writer Michael Chabon. There's music in the air, not to mention the odd chicken and motorbike. Let's go there.
Hello and welcome to this session at the Ubud Writers and Readers Festival and on ABC RN. I'm Kate Evans, delighted to be here with writer Michael Chabon, whose many books include The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, The Yiddish Policeman's Union and Telegraph Avenue. Today we'll be focusing mostly on Telegraph Avenue, but also the ways in which music moved through his writing. Please do welcome Michael Chabon.
Thank you.
Michael, you write a lot about music, but how much would you say that music has shaped you?
I think music is possibly more present and even maybe more important to me in my everyday life and in my work as well than reading, than literature. Even though reading is so fundamental to me and, you know, I make books, I don't make music, but I listen to music constantly, and I feel that I'm on a kind of perpetual quest to discover new music and to encounter new music. I'm much more open to that process of encountering music and discovering music. It's sort of always my agenda, not just, you know, when I find myself in a new country that has its own music, popular music, classical music, whatever, but just stepping out of my door every day, it's another day to possibly find out about some new band, some new artist that I haven't heard of before. And I'm not like that at all about literature. I have a very, I kind of pulled up the ladders of my fortress a long time ago, and I'm much stingier about encountering new works of fiction and new literature. I'm much more suspicious. I have to have something recommended to me a few times by people who are both very trustworthy and very insistent before I will really take a chance on a new book. I think possibly partly because it takes a lot longer to read a book and you have to invest a lot more time in a novel. And sometimes it's not until you're 200, 300, or 400 pages into the novel that you decide it's not worth it. Whereas with a song on the radio, it's a kind of an instantaneous thing, and you can kind of can consume it over and over and over again within a relatively short period of time in a way that you can't with a work of fiction.
What about music and memory, though? How much are you haunted by music collections from the past?
Well, I think the way that music and works for me in my way of remembering things is much more as a like a preservative medium, like amber, that certain songs, certain albums, certain pieces of music will, by virtue of my having listened to them a lot during a certain period of my life or because I associate them with a particular people or social milieu that I was part of, if I have a random encounter with a song, particular song, after many years, it has that kind of Proustian element of just suddenly bringing back this powerful sensory associations with that time and that place, what I was doing, who I was with. There are certain songs that, you know, particularly because if I don't hear them too frequently, that just instantly conjure up an entire visual, auditory, olfactory kind of moment in my life.
Well, it's interesting you say visual. You reference the visual there because your writing is so imbued with popular culture references as well. Do you see that as separate to music or the same thing?
Well, I understand the distinction between popular culture and unpopular culture. And I understand the various kinds of criteria that various people employ when trying to draw lines between popular culture and high culture or whatever you want to call it. But I don't feel those distinctions at all. I never have. And I don't really, to me, to make a reference to, I don't know, like a Debussy piece of Debussy music and Star Trek episode in the same paragraph, I don't feel like I'm dipping my ladle into two different buckets. It's all coming out of the same bucket as far as I'm concerned. I think that's partly a function of the fact that my father had a big influence on me, especially when I was young. His taste and things he was excited about, and his taste was very lowercase C Catholic, and you know, he loved Star Trek is a great example, and he also read a lot of serious challenging literature, and he liked Japanese monster movies, and he liked classical music, and he didn't ever seem to sort of say, well, this stuff's crappy, but I like it anyway, or you have to be a little bit blushing about the fact that you enjoyed Planet of the Apes sequel movies more than the original. It was all just enthusiasm, and that coupled with the moment that I was coming of age in, you know, in American culture, where pop culture and pop art and sort of the idea of breaking down boundaries between what was considered previously to be high culture and low culture, you know, that was very much the currency at the time. I think it just helped me get over that.
And I love the fact that as we're talking about sound, there's a distant goose.
Is that a goose?
Well, I don't know. It sounds like a goose. What would I know? It's probably something else, given that we're in...
Indigestion, bali belly.
But I wonder how much you think about music in the sort of texture and pace of your writing, because reading your work, it has this extraordinary pace and rhythm that I can almost hear as I'm absolutely tearing through it. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the pleasure of
Thank
your
you.
Style, is how musical it is. How conscious are you of that?
Well, it's not conscious at all in one sense, because I hear sentences, I think the word I would use is cadence. I hear a cadence before anything else, even before I know exactly what, I mean, I'll say I'm working through and I'm writing a scene and I know essentially, I don't know, a mother's going to give her son some bad news in this scene. So I know what has to happen in the scene. But beyond that, how that information is going to get conveyed, or what I'm going to choose to focus on, or what the mother might say, or what the son might be thinking, and all of those things, I have no idea about those. And I proceed by trying to attend to the cadences of sentences that there's no way to really talk about it without slowing the process down much more than how I actually experience it. But first, there's a sense of a cadence with no meaning or syllables attached. And then the words sort of start to fill in to fit that cadence. And sometimes if I don't have quite the right words, I'll reject a word because it has to be three syllables and it has to go like a bump-a-bump cadence. And maybe I'll reach for a couple of possible synonyms or choices that will fit that cadence and then keep going. And then start to think, wait, does that actually make sense? Does it actually describe the look on the son's face or the way the candle's, you know, shining on the window or whatever it might be? But all of that is very almost instantaneous. And so it's unconscious in the sense that I don't really know that I'm doing it.
And but is that an conscious, entirely internal cadence, or do you read out loud? Do you see how it sounds?
I do occasionally, but I tend to read out loud more when I'm starting to worry that I've gotten a little too fancy or a little too complicated or a little too precious or something like that, because that tends to emerge more when you start to read something aloud or you realize, I don't know, that you have so many dependent clauses before you get to the subject of the sentence that there's no way a reader's going to remember what you started out talking about at the beginning. So, you know, that's more why I would read something aloud, to just make sure I didn't get too internal in the sound of the words.
Let's get back to the music and to the object, the round black disc.
Mm-hmm.
Is it vinyl that still matters to you?
Well, I mean, obviously it's the music that matters to me most, and I can be just as transported by the experience of hearing a song coming through a crappy radio in a taxi cab through lousy speakers with terrible fidelity as I could by listening on, you know, 180 gram remastered vinyl pressing through really expensive headphones. But I love vinyl records, partly because obviously that's what I grew up with, partly because I do think the sound quality is better, especially for music that was recorded in the analog originally, was not digitally recorded. It was recorded in a real room with real people playing real acoustic instruments or instruments that involve the transmission of sound waves in some way. So to me, that just sounds better. And also, as work, I tend to listen to records most while I'm writing. I can't listen to any kind of music while I'm writing. I can really only listen to certain kinds that aren't too intrusive. But the great thing about vinyl records is they tend to be about 20 minutes long, and then you get to the end of the side. In the case of the turntable that I have now, it just gets to the label and it just sticks there and starts going. It makes this annoying sound that you can't ignore. Is also bad for your stylus. So I have to get up. And, you know, the experts tell you to get up every 20 minutes and stretch. And, you know, so for me, I've incorporated it into my, ergonomic routine to make sure that I'm up and walking around. And I stretch and I get a drink of water and turn the record over, sit back down again.
In this novel, Telegraph Avenue, vinyl records really matter. And as I was reading it, I also couldn't help but think about Nick Hornby's description of a record shop and people who knew deep in their soul that on a Saturday afternoon, the only way it could be complete was if they had a certain sized square packet under their arm and they'd found the thing to take home with them. Tell us about the record store that you imagine. It does so many more things than sell records. So as a space, what's so interesting about it for you?
In a way, it almost has nothing to do with records at all. And it, as much as I love records and as much money and time and love as I've lavished on them over the years, it could just as easily have been one of a number of other kinds of spaces that interested me. It just so happens that having only recently moved to Berkeley, California, right on a line between Berkeley and Oakland, California, and trying to get to know that place, and this was in the about 99 or so. We moved there in 97. And I was trying to sort of turn this into my hometown and really get to know the place. And one thing I had started to notice, it's immediately apparent to anybody that spends any amount of time in the East Bay, is especially Berkeley, but this is true of Oakland to a degree. Berkeley has had a tendency to sort of hold on to various kinds of informal communal spaces that in some ways function very similarly to the way a pub functions or has traditionally functioned. It's like a gathering place for people who share a common interest in something, you know, whether it's ale or vinyl records or knitting or tube amplifiers, vintage tube amplifiers, or African-American books. Or there were, and there still are, all these spaces that are not just a store selling a particular kind of product, but also when you walk in there, they're gathering places. And you, if you sort of quietly go stand in the corner, you can eavesdrop on the conversation that people who are enthusiasts for whatever it is are having. And it might be more or less true with different kinds of spaces, but with a vinyl record store, a used record store in Berkeley or Oakland, California, there can be a remarkable degree of diversity. Not that many women, let's be honest. But apart from that, black, white, old, young, young guys who are digging through the crates looking for things to sample for their hip-hop recordings, and old jazz enthusiasts and doctors with plenty of disposable income to spend, and people who just love old records. And they might just be sort of standing around at the front talking. And I happened to walk into a used record store, as I'm saying, a couple years after getting Berkeley, and there were two guys working at the counter. One was a white guy, one was a black guy. And they were definitely in the kings of the... They were in charge, and they had a certain swagger and a kind of verbal riffs they would get going and teasing each other. And then these customers were coming in and going out and stopping and chatting, and they were all different kinds of people. And I just suddenly had this feeling of that there was this little magical space was being created where people who might otherwise have nothing in common or little in common, but who had this one thing in common, could come together. And that was a very powerful moment for me because, well, for a lot of reasons, but I grew up in a place called Columbia, Maryland. That was a planned community that was designed and constructed in the mid to late 1960s along very kind of 1960s utopian liberal progressive lines. It was intended to be interracial, multi-faith, had a kind of utopian experimental quality to it, even though it was in other ways very much just sort of a garden variety suburb between Baltimore, Maryland, and Washington, D.C. And I moved there when I was six, and I was very invested in the idea of Columbia, that this, again, this was a place, if you moved to Columbia, especially if you're a white family moving to Columbia, for black families, it represented an opportunity to purchase a house in a time and in a place, Baltimore, Maryland, where black people were still unofficially completely excluded from buying houses. So maybe it was a little less utopian. But for white families, if you moved there, it was because you believed, at least in part, because you believed in this place. And for me, as like a six-year-old kid, I really believed in it. So I think that idea of that sort of small space where we say, like, let's just forget all the things that we don't have in common, and let's focus on the things we do, is a very powerful one for me.
That real record shop that you walked into mm-hmm. with those guys riffing to each other, mm-hmm. had it also been a barbershop, or were you just imagining those layers of community collection and spaces?
You mean like in the shop like in the book? I have no idea. I don't know. I made that up. Over time, as I was writing this book, I started to get more interested in sort of the commercial history, the commercial retail history of my neighborhood and the neighborhoods that I hang out in. And so I did start to hear, and anytime I met anybody that had grown up in Oakland or Berkeley, I would start grilling them about where did you used to go, what did you used to do, what used to be there, tell me about things where you pass a corner and you think, oh, that's where that used to be and that's where that used to be. Because I had to write a character who had grown up in Oakland, and I knew that was going to be part of his consciousness that I couldn't otherwise reproduce. And you can't just Google that kind of stuff. You can't Google to find out what store used to be there before, three stores ago, before whatever's there now. You know, I would hear about places, this place used to be a barbershop, or that place used to be whatever, and so it felt plausible to me, and it felt right, and then I kind of just, what I really wanted to do was make this record store, in this book, plausibly important, not just to the guys who go there to buy records, but to the whole block, and to the whole neighborhood, and to the history of the neighborhood, and so maybe as a vinyl record store, it's not that important to somebody that was who lived there, you know, since 1935 or whatever. But what if it also had this longer history as an important space? And what will the loss of that space represent? Because the record store is endangered in this book.
And it is the stage upon which so much action happens and centers and moves around, not just, as you say, the record shop, mm-hmm. but also the avenue. But I'm interested in that sort of performance aspect of it, because I believe you started to write it as a TV show or, mm-hmm. or a film rather than as a book. Mm-hmm. So why did you do that, and why did you end up with this novel?
Why did I start as a TV show? Because I got asked if I wanted to create a TV show for TNT Network in the U.S., and it was kind of the first idea that came to me. I mean, it seemed to me TV shows, like the ones I like the most, typically are about a place or a space. I mean, it's the same kind of idea. The great TV series have often been about this sort of notional community where people who don't necessarily have that much in common could have come together to do something in common. The record shop felt like it fit right in with that idea. You know, I wrote a script for a pilot that went nowhere, wasn't used, and then it sat around, and I've done that many times, and I have tons of unused projects lying around, but this one just stuck with me. And I kept thinking about it, even as I was finishing other projects, I kept thinking, well, maybe I wish I had done something with that record store. And it's not just the record store. The other whole big chunk of this book is about these two midwives whose husbands own the record store, and they're nurse midwives. And the whole idea of the practice of nurse midwifery, of being a midwife, seemed like initially really good material for a TV series. You know, you could have like every episode. There could be a different kind of birth story that would occur. But in that case, too, I kept coming back to it. And in fact, I wrote a short story that had a different midwife as a character in it. And, you know, having both gone through four pregnancies to term with my wife, and then listening to other women's birth stories and meeting lots of women in Berkeley who are midwives and or doulas, and it just seemed like a very Berkeley kind of thing to be doing, but it also had the same quality that vinyl records have for me, that so much else that is at least touched on in this book has, which is this something that I'm fascinated by, this idea of things that are discarded prematurely, or the idea that we have this kind of modern idea that things have to succeed each other, and they can't, if something new comes along, it has to just kill or replace the thing that preceded it, which is so wrong and so counterintuitive. And so, you know, with vinyl records, the CD came along, everybody threw their records away or gave their records away. We all bought CDs, and then sure enough, the MP3 came along and killed the CD. But vinyl was better in many ways, and it has proven that by coming back now, and is, you know, I forget, I just read like 35 million new records were pressed last year or something like that. And the same with midwifery, at least in America. I don't know, in other places I know it's not the case, but in the U.S., at a certain point, it was just tossed out, and everybody went to have their babies in the hospital, and that was it. And it's not because having your baby in the hospital is better, or having your baby with a doctor is better. And so little by little, people started to kind of look back and say, wait a second, there was this other way of doing things that, at least in certain circumstances and cases, is as good, if not superior, to the way that we thought was going to be the new way of doing things. So I just have, I don't know, I have a tender spot, I have a soft spot for good things that have been discarded.
And there's one particular scene involving the midwives that I would so love to see on screen. And it involves a huge and injudicious outpouring of anger by one of the midwives to this doctor who's behaving like a complete prat. Mm-hmm. And it's so wonderfully theatrical. And, you know, and obviously it works in the novel. But I wondered if that was one of the scenes
Yes, for sure.
Can you describe the scene?
Well, the two, like the two owners of the record shop, Archie and Nat. Archie is a black man, Nat's a white man, and Archie's married to Gwen, who's black, and Nat's married to Aviva, who's white. And so Aviva is kind of in my book, is the dean of Berkeley midwives. She's been in practice for a very long time. She's trained many of midwives. She's like, at some point, someone teasingly refers to her as the Alice Waters of midwives. She's sort of like this, like the source of Berkeley midwifery knowledge. And Gwen, we eventually learn, has sort of sought her out initially, because among the many communities that have had discarded the practice of the use of midwives, the African-American community, you know, sort of just whole hog, just jumped on board the having your babies in the hospital thing. She has this idea of trying to restore the place of midwifery, particularly in the African-American community, and she's chosen Aviva to sort of study with, and they ended up becoming partners, and they've been in practice together for a good decade now. And when we meet them, just certain fissures have started to appear between them. And Gwen, in particular, starts to take a look around their practice and her life and realize that the only women whose babies she's catching are those of white ladies, and of, you know, a lot of them being sort of middle class, upper middle class white women. And she has this moment of saying, "What am I doing here? How did I get here when that's not where I started?" And at the same time, I don't know if there's any analogy to this in outside of the United States, but doctors in hospitals, particularly as late as when this book is set in 2004, tended to be quite hostile to midwives, nurse midwives, the idea of home births, And when I spoke to a lot of nurse midwives when I was doing the research, I got a lot of stories about various ways they had been treated shabbily or with hostility. And I think these factors kind of come together on this one day for Gwen, where she's both dissatisfied on a kind of global level and then just gets treated very disrespectfully by a doctor in the larger context of always getting treated disrespectfully by doctors. And just she kind of snaps and she lets him have it.
She and blasts she snaps him. Quite wonderfully. There's another character that I want to ask you about in this novel. His name is Moby. Mm-hmm. He makes some of the other characters squirm for various reasons. Mm-hmm. Why are they squirming?
Well, it's particularly... Moby is... He is a lawyer. He represents whales bringing suit on their behalf against, like, the U.S. Navy and so on, people who are doing various kinds of disruptive behavior. He's trying to bring kind of like class action lawsuits on behalf of whales. And since he himself is white and big, somewhat cetacean, and his name is Mike Oberstein, so people call him Moby. And he is from, I think one of the characters thinks he's from Iowa or Indiana or Illinois or another state that starts with an I. You know, he's not an urban person at all, but he loves black music and jazz and hip-hop, and he kind of affects this this style of speech where he thinks he's sounding kind of street, I think. Sound talking like he's a rapper, but he's not. He's a 35-year-old, 300-pound white guy from Iowa. And he's a nice man, and his heart is obviously in the right place, and he spends a lot of money in the record store. But for Nat Jaffe, the white half of the partnership that owns the record store, and Nat, who grew up in a black neighborhood of Richmond, Virginia, with a black stepmother, being raised by a black stepmother, has always been just not just careful, not just studious, but almost obsessive about avoiding any appearance of trying to pass as black or to affect. He could so easily do it if he wanted to. It's in his training, but it's like a taboo for him.
So is Moby a way for you to deal with criticism about being a white writer writing about black characters and black music?
It's not really that I'm worried about criticism at all. In fact, I'm not worried about criticism, but what I do believe is that you need to acknowledge what's going on under the surface of pretty much anything you do in life. I think it's okay for a white... Obviously, it's okay for a white person to love black music, and I think it's more than okay for a white novelist to write about black characters from their points of view. And in this novel, toward the end, having stayed in Gwen's point of view from the beginning, when she herself is pregnant, when she goes into labor and has her baby, I'm in her point of view, so I'm not just writing from the point of view of a black woman, but from a black woman who's having a baby. So I'm so far from anything I've ever experienced in my life. I think there's nothing wrong with that either. Everyone, all writers should be free to write from whatever points of view they want to. But if you do it, you have to acknowledge. You can't just blithely do it. So in the case of a white writer writing from a point of view of a black character, you can't just ignore, you know, let's call it 200 years, 150 years, whatever, of appropriation of black art by white artists. You know, going back from minstrelsy in the days of the minstrel shows all the way through Blue-Eyed Soul and so many aspects of pop culture today. You know, you can't ignore that. You have to acknowledge it. You have to face it in various ways. And I wanted to try to signal to any reader who is paying attention in various ways throughout the book that I was not unaware, that I know that this is a fraught area. So, you know, there's Moby. There's a lot of talk about Quentin Tarantino movies. And so Tarantino's a great example of an artist who has, his bread and butter has been adopting tropes and images and music and all kinds of blaxploitation cinema and all kinds of things that are coming out of African American culture. He's great. I love his movies, but one thing I might criticize him for is a little. I think he could do a little better about acknowledging the minefield aspect of it and just being upfront about that. I have. I don't know. I have all kinds of little signals to the reader saying, "Yeah, I know this is. I know what I'm doing here has a history, and it's some of that history is ugly or is reprehensible."
Another place where it feels like you're being clever and playful is in the character of Cochise Jones, who is a musician and a record collector. And in fact, it feels to me as a reader that the whole book is building up to his funeral.
Mm-hmm.
But for a character who's embedded in music and a book that's embedded in music, he's surrounded by really interesting silences.
Mm.
How would you describe this man? And perhaps you should tell us what he looks like, how he dressed.
Cochise Jones is he's the fixture of the store. He's always there. This store, in the book, more so than in the store that inspired me to write the book, the store has almost like a bar. It has this front glass counter where the two guys who run the store stand behind it or sit behind it with the cash register, and then there are some stools, like bar stools, right in the front. So people do come in, they drop by, and they sit there, and they chat, and there's a stool there in a corner that is Mr. Jones's stool. Anytime he's in the store, that's where he sits, and he's there almost every day. And he's a little bit of an enigmatic figure because he's a great of jazz, so he played on all these as a sideman on all these records in the 60s and 70s. He recorded one solo album with his own band under his own name. He had been very well known. He's still probably very well known among aficionados, but he never made any money doing it. He's not a wealthy man by any means. He lives alone. He's kind of a lonely figure. He has, for his sole companion, he has a parrot, a talking parrot, a very intelligent talking parrot that is known to him as 58. People who have read some of my other books might wonder if this African gray parrot might be related to the African gray parrot who is central to the plot of a little short novel I wrote called The Final Solution. In that book, the parrot's name is Bruno, and in fact, in my mind, it's actually the same parrot.
You like giving those little gifts to the readers, for careful
Easter
reading.
Eggs. Yeah, I mean, it's there if you, and there are actually some pretty direct clues too if you for someone who wants to notice that kind of thing. Bruno, or 58, is, in both cases, is sort of the spokesman, in a sense, for a character who doesn't talk much. And sometimes the things that 58 says, there's a passage where Mr. Jones thinks about, when we're in his point of view, and he thinks about how he, in the 70s, especially in the early 70s, he never talked very much, which I think is partly how he got his nickname Cochise, which is the name of an American Indian war leader and chief, and a sort of stereotypical notion of like Indians who don't talk much. And he has some Indian heritage as well, so that's probably why he has this nickname, that he felt trapped in that role of the strong, silent type when he was young, and now he feels trapped in his role, sort of like the friendly old man that everybody loves, and every so often the parrot will break out with a really irritable, angry statement that obviously the parrot has heard many times coming out of, and he sounds just like Mr. Jones, and it's a little bit embarrassing for everyone when the parrot does that, but there's an element of, I think there's an element of frustration in Cochise Jones, of a kind of frustrated self that never quite got expressed except when he was at the keys. His chosen instrument was the Hammond B3 organ. So it's only when he was playing that he's really able to express himself. And there's a passage in the book that where I tried to describe what his music sounds like, which is hard to do. And one strong element in that music is anger. There's a lot of fury and anger and outrage, and it's reflected in various kind of musical ways in his playing. And that's how that comes out, except for the parrot.
Well, in fact, there's an extraordinary passage when you describe, and I think it's over a couple of pages, it's one song being played by this man. And you describe all of the things and all the musical influences, and it's on I Don't Know How to Love Him from Jesus Christ Superstar. Right. Is that something where you are imagining a piece of music that doesn't exist? Or are you describing a piece of music that you've heard?
There is a performance of I Don't Know How to Love Him by, not Jimmy Smith, by, I'm blanking now, I can't remember, by a jazz organ player. And in part, that was the initial germ of inspiration. And there's something just in that song title itself and what it's trying to express, that I don't know how to love him. Is there's that frustration, there's that sense of you have this emotion that you don't really know what to do with. And that just sort of started to work on me and gave me the idea of shaping that passage around it.
So given that, and given that you are able to describe a three-minute song over, you know, four or five pages that embeds itself in the history of a character and the history of music and influences, could you write your own autobiography in terms of your music collection?
Yeah, has anybody done that yet? That's a good idea. I mean, it's a little bit like the thing in High Fidelity where he, at one point, the protagonist organizes his record collection by autobiographically instead of alphabetically or some other way. Possibly, yeah. No, I mean, I definitely would mark certain eras in my life as they would have a soundtrack, unquestionably.
Would be quite happy to sit here all afternoon talking to you about the nuances of this book and your processes of writing, but I know this quite large room is full of people who would rather they were doing that. So I think this would be a good opportunity to hear from you, and if you've got some questions for Michael Chabon.
Hey Michael.
Hi Ben.
As a music journalist, I read like a lot of like Greil Marcus, Lester Bangs, and I'm just wondering, during the writing of this book, did you have an author, like say for instance when you're writing the passage that's three or four pages long, did you have someone you went back to, like where you needed that, like to kind of start that cascading flow of words that you spoke about earlier?
I don't think, I mean, both Lester Bangs and Greil Marcus, particularly Greil Marcus, he's a very important writer to me, and his books have been among my most revered teachers, if you will, and learning about music, and maybe to a degree learning how to write about music. But even in the case of writers as great as those two and many other great writers, I find that I very rarely agree with the words that writers who make a living writing about music tend to use when they're actually describing the sound of music. It often have the experience of it doesn't sound like that to me, or that's not how I would describe it. So, you know, and it's particularly, for the most part, the descriptions of music and the sound of music, to coin a phrase, are pretty limited to pieces of music that I'm making up, in a sense, that I'm imagining. So I just sort of try to fly solo in that sense. I did read a lot of source material about music to just be able to pretend that I was as knowledgeable about what my characters are selling as they are. I had to pass myself off as someone who's fully steeped in and immersed in the kind of vinyl these guys specialize in, which by the time I was done, I actually was, but when I started, I was not. And so I did do a lot of reading, you know, both of magazines and on the web and of texts as well, books as well, but not so much when it came time to describe the music.
So, I think you're famous for having a fertile, delightful imagination. And today is the start of NaNoWriMo, which is National Novel Writing Month, maybe Worldwide Novel Writing Month these days. And I guess I was just wondering if you might say something about how you nurture your imagination and keep it so active and open up to those parts of yourself.
how do I? Well,
when you say, whenever I hear the word imagination, and especially if people are trying to ask me about me and my imagination, I just flash back to this moment when I think I was in about second grade, and I wrote something and I illustrated it in school, and I took it up to my teacher and showed it to the teacher, and she looked at it, read it, and she said, "Wow, you have a great imagination." And I was said to myself, "Like I do, that's cool." And in a way, I would have to say, almost from that moment forward, I never thought about it ever again. It was just like somebody saying, "You have red hair." Like, yes, I know I have red hair, but I don't have red hair. But my wife has red hair. Rambut merah. I mean, to me, the most important thing about imagination has nothing to do with writing. It has nothing to do with art, writing screenplays. To me, the most important kind of imagination, I shouldn't say it has nothing to do with writing, but it's not just about writing. It's the ability to imagine what it's like to be somebody else. And the duty, the obligation that we all have to try to imagine what it's like to be somebody else. And the more you force yourself to do that, because it's hard, it's a lot. I mean, you're stuck inside here, and everyone else is out there. And depending on what culture they're from, what background they're from, what kind of upbringing, what language they speak, whatever it might be, each of those sort of adds an element of difficulty, just like a complicated gymnastics move. There are some that are scored more highly because they have greater elements of difficulty, and it's harder and harder to do the sort of the farther and farther away that you get from your own place that you come from, and more important I think it is to do that the farther away that you get. And I do believe that to some degree, reading literature, reading fiction, which fundamentally comes from another consciousness, out of another human mind, is not just arising from another human mind, but is often, in the case of fiction, has a double consciousness. It's the consciousness of the author's mind and then the characters within the fictional structure, so that you're reading a novel by an Italian novelist who's a man about a woman. So you're getting this chance to not only have contact with another mind, the mind of the author, but to be in the life of another person. And I think the more you do that, the easier it becomes to try to imagine what it's like to be somebody else. So to me, like, that imagination, almost like the moral imagination, I think is the most important kind, much more important to me than the other kind that I don't even think about or take it for granted. That comes easily to me, or more easily. It's remembering just to stop and say, oh, that person who just said something annoying or borderline offensive, like, I wonder what's going on behind all that that got them to express that statement. And maybe there's some forgiveness there often, too.
So it sounds like fiction and empathy and teachers. And there were about five of you there, so I'll let you fight to the death over who gets the next microphone, and then we'll get a question from over this direction.
I wanted to ask you about the final solution, and keeping on with this notion of imagination and being inside a character. What drew you to writing a book about a character being Sherlock Holmes, which so many people already had an imagination of what that character was and had done?
Well, I'm a fan, fundamentally. And in fact, it'd probably be fair to say that, at least when it comes to writing, that's my first fandom, was Sherlock Holmes. I started to read those stories around the age of 10 and just got very into it, and not just into the stories themselves, but the whole sort of fandom around those stories. That's often, that's called being a Sherlockian or a Holmesian. It kind of was the internet before the internet in terms of the way that the web supports fandom so powerfully now. And there it even had fan fiction, a long-standing tradition by the time I discovered it, of some like 50, 60 years of people writing their own, as you say, of writing their own Holmes pieces. And for me, I had gotten into these stories and I was excited about them. And then this was about 1973. A man named Nicholas Mayer published a novel that was a bestseller called The 7% Solution. That was a novel about, it was a Sherlock Holmes story. It was narrated by Dr. Watson. And he tried to just completely reproduce the tone and the feel of the original stories. And, you know, not only did I love this book in which Sherlock Holmes seeks treatment with Sigmund Freud for his cocaine addiction, but I was kind of shocked and stunned. It was a really enlightening moment. Like, you could do that? You could write your own Sherlock Holmes story? You can just do that? And so I immediately, first thing I ever wrote was a Sherlock Holmes story. So I wrote a story with, just coincidentally, right around then, my English teacher assigned a short story. And I decided to write my own Sherlock Holmes story, in which Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson meet Captain Nemo from 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And, you know, I loved doing it so much, and it was so pleasurable for me to pay attention to the language of Conan Doyle and say, well, what is it about these sentences that makes them sound the way they do, and how do I make my sentences sound like these sentences? What words is he choosing? What diction? What tone of voice? And so on. And then just getting to write dialogue for Watson and Holmes, banter between them and so on, all the things that are sort of the hallmarks of a classic, especially the opening two pages of any Sherlock Holmes story. You know, it was really pleasurable. And then I got an A from my teacher. You know, and my parents were very receptive and encouraging, and that was almost like with the earlier moment with imagination. It was just, I'd say, okay, well, that's what I'm going to do now. I'm just going to be a writer. So The Final Solution arose many years later after I was starting to feel like realist or naturalistic fiction, mainstream fiction, fiction that was not overtly coming out of a genre like science fiction or fantasy or crime fiction or whatever, was feeling a little restrictive to me. And I also started to realize that the books I was writing, whatever I might think of them, this is before The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, really, the books that I was writing did not at all reflect the kind of books I read and still read. I had much more diversity in what I was reading than what I was writing, and I wondered what was going on there. Why wasn't I writing the range of books that I was reading? And I think that was a very natural and obvious first step to me, in a sense, to go back to Holmes and to write this piece of fiction. But this time I didn't try to do the pastiche and just straight out imitate Conan Doyle's style or Dr. Watson's voice. And in fact, my model was for that book was Robert Louis Stevenson's novellas, you know, The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, maybe more than any of the others, but a number of his other novellas where he would have a different point of view in each chapter or change point of views frequently, even, which is sort of unusual in a small space now in contemporary fiction, to change point of views. We have this tyranny of Henry James' idea that, you know, of unity of point of view within a compressed space. Also, Edgar Allan Poe is partly to blame for that. And so that was more my structural model. So I do go into the point of view, the mind of this very elderly Sherlock Holmes and all the people around him, including ultimately the mind of the parrot that I mentioned earlier, who, like, that was not intentional. I didn't know when I started that I was going to be trying to write from the point of view of a parrot. I wasn't really sure I knew how to write from the point of view of a parrot, even though I do have this sense of obligation to imagine what it's like to be somebody else. But I had to, because I realized I had written myself. The book is a mystery. Whatever, I really did endeavor to have it, there be a crime and a solution and red herrings and all the things you expect from a mystery novel. And I realized pretty late in the process that the only character who knew the truth, who knew the solution, was the parrot. And that presented me with a little bit of a problem. And I had just gotten to that part of the book and was sort of just confronting the full, not horror exactly, but just wondering if this was a ridiculous, stupid thing to try to do, to write from the point of view of an African gray parrot, when I happened to exchange very briefly some emails with Salman Rushdie, who's not, I'm not like name dropping, he's not like my best buddy or anything like that, but I have met him, and I had to ask him a question, something totally unrelated. I was trying to get him to participate in something I was doing. And I had his attention, right? I had just communicated, and I was trying to struggle with this. I'm like, you know who would know if you can write from the point of view of a parrot? Salman Rushdie. So I asked him. I sort of just briefly described what happened and told him where I was, and I said, so can I do this? And he wrote back a 2-word email. It said, you must.
And of course, the parrot survives Cochise Jones's death at Telegraph Avenue.
Yes. So, and I return to his point of view in this book. Mm-hmm.
There'll be more of the parrot.
Hi, I've imagined a couple of the books that I've read as movies. Are any of them being made into movies? And would you turn over the rights to the screenplay? Would you willingly just give up the book and have someone else write the screenplay and say, it's not mine anymore, you take it?
Of course I would, because they pay you, they give you money. And I mean, if they weren't giving me any money in return, no, I would not. But they do give you money. Like, sometimes a not very reasonable amount. Like, it doesn't really seem like they are in full control of their faculties, given the relatively few number of people who read even a literary novel that does well. Still, we're talking in that we're counting in five figures often, number of hardcover copies that have sold. And so sometimes I don't think they really know what they're doing. Don't tell them I said that, though. You know, I mean, when I hear authors complaining, which is not that common, but often sort of prominent authors of vampire novels, for example, who protest the shabby treatment that their novel received at the hands of Hollywood. You know, there's whenever you encounter that, you just have to remind yourself, nobody forced them to sell their book to Hollywood. You can say no. And many writers do say no. Many writers are sort of famous for having never allowed. Thomas Pynchon, I think, just recently gave over some kind of limited rights to one of his books, but he doesn't do that. And there have been offers. And other writers kind of hold out until they do have control, like John Irving, well, is well known for that, or John Grisham.
And Michael Connelly. Michael, exactly. Just EP'd Bosch.
You can do that, too. So you don't have to take the money. I'm not in a position where I can have that kind of courage and integrity. But actually, one of my books has been filmed. It was a book called Wonder Boys, and it was made into a movie with Robert Downey Jr. and Michael Douglas and Tobey Maguire. As some people like to say, it's the movie with Iron Man, Spider-Man, and Ant-Man. And it's a good movie, and I had nothing to do with that. And that's, you know, that's great. I'm glad the movie came out great. It didn't really do very well, probably because it was so good, but... I was excited to see that movie, and I was happy that the people that had made it had obviously understood the book and done a good job. But if it had been terrible, and actually, I take it back, there was another movie adaptation of another one of my books that was not so great, and it's okay. The book is the book. You know, the movie is the movie. There are two different things. There's a famous story about James M. Cain, the guy who wrote Postman Always Rings Twice and Double Indemnity, and somebody asked him, Mr. Cain, how do you feel about the way Hollywood has treated your books? And he said, my books are over there on the shelf. You know, Hollywood hasn't done anything to them. So it's easy. It's easy to give up that. It's not my book anymore. Thank you. Thank you.
Michael Chabon's Telegraph Avenue is published by Fourth Estate. He's written many books, and you can find links to the rest of them on our website, abc.net.au/rn. And if you're wondering, all of the music you heard today on Best of the Festivals was mentioned in his book. Michael Chabon was on stage with RN's Kate Evans at the Ubud Writers Festival in Indonesia. I'm Cassie McCullough, and this is the final of our Best of Festivals series for this time round anyway. And don't forget, you can always listen to anything again online or via podcast. It's bye for now, but I'll be off dreaming of music and parrots.